Hey, guys. How's things? Oh, yeah? All right. Good. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Yeah, this mic is a little in the wrong spot. Here, fix that. Hey, it's my show, Libertarian Foreign Policy, mostly. I'm here noon to 2 Eastern Time on Liberty Radio Network. LRN.FM, LibertyRadioNetwork.com. And, on Sunday mornings, mostly, I'm on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, except during Fun Drive, then I'm preempted. But otherwise. Alright, cool. So today on the show, Gene Healy will be here to, talk a little bit about the presidential candidates and their political positions. Gene Healy, Vice President of Cato. And also Gareth Porter will be back on the show to talk about the Iran nuclear deal and what it means and what it does not mean for American foreign policy moving forward. Moving forward. I hate that. You know, from here on, man, into the future compared to now. All right. A few more invites out than that. It's possible we'll have one more guest. It's a race now. See who says yes first at this point. But lots of important stuff to cover. So, we will. Alright. Jeez, I guess I meant to write a blog entry. Yeah, I'll do that the next break. I know. Join up the chat room. I'll do the same right now. ScottHorton.org/chat. ScottHorton.org/chat. Just a fake name and a CAPTCHA and you're in. It's an IRC Freenode chat. If you have a standalone chat program type thing, hashtag Scott Horton Show. If you want to hang out with the boys in there. Hey, guys. Yeah, there's a few people in there. How's things? So join up, scotthorton.org/chat. All right, cool. So, I don't have very good notes as far as preparation this morning, but I got a hell of a lot of tabs open here and a lot of important things to talk about. So I'm going to put that off because that might be an interview later. And that's one of the interviews I got going. So is that. So I guess... I'd like to mention this. I think, you know, this will come up in the context of the Gene Healy interview, but I'm going to try to get an interview with this author separately. His name is Brandon George Whitehall. Nope, Whitehill. Brandon George Whitehill. And he wrote this thing at Foreign Policy Research Institute, which I have no idea what that is, but, you know, presumably funded by bad guys. But anyway, no problem, because it's a really good rundown here. He calls it a quick guide to the foreign policy views of the Democratic presidential candidates, but it's pretty thorough for a quick one. Then he goes through and describes Hillary Clinton, Jim Webb, Bernie Sanders, and is it Martin O'Malley, and Lincoln Chafee, and all their positions on the different wars and whatever. And it's very well worth your reading, you know, if you like reading about stuff like that. We're running it today, I think, as a viewpoint on antiwar.com, even though it's really just kind of a news thing. Yeah, it's a viewpoint today on antiwar.com, if you want to check it out there. Guide to the Foreign Policy Views of the Democratic Presidential Candidates. And this will be, you know, obviously will be discussed in, no, not that kind of disgust, the other kind of disgust with Gene Healy here in just a few minutes. All right. Now, Phil Giraldi was on the show last week, and we talked about this. And in fact, remember he had said, well, yeah, I'm working on a new article about the Turks and the war in Syria. And then we discussed this on the show, and he emailed me and said, you know what? I'm changing. I'm putting off the Turkey article, and I'm going right after the EFP propaganda. That's, you might remember during the wars, during the years of Iraq War II, American soldiers were being blown up by roadside bombs called IEDs, improvised explosive devices. And then at some point, the acronym changed. And it was mostly propaganda, but it was also sort of a reflection of some reality on the ground, but only kinda, that they changed the name from IED to EFP, explosively formed penetrator. Now, it's a roadside bomb, but it's a shaped charge and it has a copper core, which can melt through armor, I guess. However exactly that works. Anyway, they were used primarily by the Shiite militias who were resisting the Americans, as opposed to the Shiite militias that were working for the United States of America. Well, that America was working for. But anyway, as Giraldi shows in this article, there was never any evidence that these EFPs came from Iran. Certainly not that there was some systematic chain of, you know, importation going on here. Supply chain, you know, a box of bombs here or there, maybe, but what does that indicate? Nothing. No chain of custody whatsoever. And, by the way, garage machine shops were found over and over again in Iraq, where Arabs were perfectly capable of making IEDs with copper cores. And so, it's just not true that these bombs came from Iran. And I was doing a radio show at the time, and what had happened was they sort of dropped the propaganda about the Iranian nuclear bomb for a minute, and they decided to switch the subject to Iranian intervention in Iraq. And they always try to conflate who was resisting the Americans. At first, when they started propagandizing about Iran giving bombs to the resistance, they were accusing Iran of giving bombs to the Al-Qaeda guys, to the Sunni resistance, who are resisting America's effort to put Iran's sock puppets in power, the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council and their militia, the Bada Brigade. Why in the world would Iran be doing that? They weren't. It was a lie. And then when it was the Shiite militias resisting the United States, they weren't the Iran-backed militias. The militias that were resisting the Shiite militias that were resisting the United States were mostly the Mahdi army, and he was the Iraqi Arab nationalist, who even though he's a Shiite kind of wannabe Ayatollah of a lower rank, his father and father-in-law had higher religious ranks, but anyway, he always wanted, well, I don't know always, but he mostly wanted Iraqi nationalism and wanted to limit the role of Iran and the United States at the same time, which made sense since it was America that was empowering Iran more than anybody else. And he wanted Arab-Iraqi alliance, and with the Kurds too, in the name of Iraqi nationalism against all foreign intervention. And so he was actually fighting against America's efforts to fight for Iran's interests when forcing us out. And it was the Iranians that brokered his ceasefire against the American forces too. So anyway, Phil Giraldi writes here at UNZ.com, U-N-Z, UNZ.com, former CIA and DIA counterterrorism officer Phil Giraldi, did Iranian weapons kill Americans? Another phony argument against a deal with Iran. And yeah, he demolishes them. And he's done this for years. So we talked about this. He covered this. He debunked this full scale back in 2007. You can find his articles at antiwar.com about it back then. Of course, so did Gareth Porter and Patrick Coburn and many others. Patrick Coburn, I couldn't find the essay, or the news story, but I swear to you, it was November 2006 that Patrick Coburn first went on to the site of an American battle slash seizure of a weapons factory, and there they were making copper core bombs in Baghdad. And that was before the surge ever even started. UNZ.com for that, again. Back in a sec. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well.
They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. So, I think it's past time we legalize heroin, don't you? And aren't you sick and tired of everybody being afraid to say that? Oh, what an extreme position. Let me stop and take a deep breath and get my emotions in order before I hear such a radical statement as the war on drugs is stupid and evil, far more stupid and evil than heroin addiction. And heroin addiction is stupid and evil. It's horrible. If you have a wallet with some money in it, a heroin addict will steal your money. Because they will want to spend that money on heroin. This could be very problematic if you have heroin addicts in your life. You compare that to the damage of the war on drugs? You'd have to be insane to think that the government is your security service. I mean, to think that, sorry, I'm trying to make a more narrow point here, to think that the war on drugs is working, could ever work, as some bogus slogan about sending the right message to the children or whatever is good enough, important enough to justify the harm done from the war on drugs. Well, maybe legalize pot for medical reasons in a few states, some kind of thing. And of course, every conservative's argument. I remember Bob Barr running for president as a libertarian candidate. However that happened, I probably encouraged it. Went on Sean Hannity, and Sean Hannity said, "You want to legalize heroin?" And Bob Barr goes, "No, no, no, not heroin. Oh, no, I wouldn't say that. I mean, oh, oh." I think probably even Gary Johnson has the same. "Oh, no, yeah, no, not heroin. Oh, yeah, no, that would be a far too radical thing to say." Why? Legalize heroin for the same reason legalize pot, the same reason legalize tobacco. Because prohibition doesn't work. Because people are born free and they own themselves and it's up for them to decide, not you. Because we all prefer to live in a free society where questions like that aren't up to you or up to the goons that you hire to enforce your whims. It's crazy. It didn't work. It hadn't worked. There's an article in the Washington Post today. The only town in America where cops grant amnesty to drug addicts seeking help. What happened was in Gloucester, Massachusetts, another person died of a heroin overdose. Again. So the police chief, and I didn't know he had this much discretion, honestly, but all right. The police chief said, "Any junkies want to come down to the police station, I don't care if you bring your needles and your drugs with you. I will not charge you. Come down here. I will assign someone to you to put you in rehab and try to help you. No probation, no charges, no arrest, no shakedown. But if you're sick and tired of being a junkie, come on down." Now, I'm against, you know, socialism for curing people of being junkies. It's probably not the best way to do it. But whatever, it's still better than persecuting them. And then immediately, you know, 100-something junkies ran down there and said help. And came from all over, too. And, you know, how much does it cost to put a junkie in rehab and try to wean him off of heroin? Not very much. They asked the cops,
So what do all these people have in common? And the guy said, well, what they all have in common is they're all just people, man. No, you don't say. Yeah, they're all just human beings. Only these ones, well, you know, they're chasing that dragon, buddy. That's it. Could be your sister. Could be anybody. And so what we decided to do was, treat them. Now, here's what's not addressed in this article anywhere. The illegality of the drug trade. You know, throughout the entire Black Lives Matter protest movement, I don't hear anybody talking about the drug war. Maybe the Black Lives Matter people don't want to sound like they're on the side of drugs. They don't want to mix the issue. And their issue is, hey, you, stop being such a racist. Okay, well, all right. But same thing for all the, you know, pretend concern troll right-wingers saying, oh, yeah, well, what about black-on-black crime? What about black-on-black crime? Well, everybody knows that the vast majority of black-on-black and all other poor-on-poor crime is because of the war on drugs. It's because of the game that's played by the people at the very bottom of the ladder of economic opportunity, who have no industry to take part in that's worth their time other than the market that the government made black. And then so what happens in a black market? What happens in a black market is what every business wishes they could get away with in an open market. That is cartelization, enforced with deadly violence. Every one of you seen The Wire. You think any of those guys could compete in the game with Walgreens selling high-quality heroin at predictable strengths at reasonable prices with a flyer for call this number and we'll come and get you and put you in rehab if you're sick and tired of being a damn zombie stapled to it? You know? I mean, hell, you don't even have to leave your couch, man. Even just watching the slightest bit of TV in your life and you know, what is it? What does the mob do for a living? Well, they protect prostitution and they protect illegal gambling and they protect the drug trade. Wait. It's as though every time the government goes around and creates a black market, criminals go into business providing protection for that black market, making society that much more of a violent place, and of course then justifying the new armored personnel carrier that's going to come busting in, you know, your neighbors if you're lucky, you know, through their living room. This whole thing is ridiculous. Oh, but legalize heroin. Just think of the tears, the emotional reaction, the fear that people knee-jerk to say that. Oh my God. You see, didn't I tell you the slippery slope? They didn't want to legalize medical marijuana. They just wanted their foot in the door so they could legalize drugs and corrupt all of America and turn all of America into a bunch of drug addicts. Yep. Except, as the police chief says in here, we've been doing this for 50 years. And then his spoken italics, 50 years. And we have more overdoses and more heroin at cheaper prices than ever before. Afghan occupation. Enough. Legalize heroin. All capitals, bold, italics. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. and they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. Oh, yeah, that's the other thing I forgot to say. AIDS. If you are for the prohibition of heroin, then you are pro-AIDS. And shame on you. How did I forget and leave that out? Anyway, on to our next guest. Our first guest today on the show, it's Gene Healy, Vice President of the Cato Institute, author of the book, The Cult of the Presidency. Welcome back to the show, Gene. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Very happy to have you back on the show. So the news is, well, there's a lot of news, but Donald Trump has explained that he gets all his foreign policy news from his advice, not his news, his foreign policy advice, everything he knows about foreign policy, he gets from watching TV. He likes John Bolton. He's a very no-nonsense kind of a guy. Really like him. And that's it. And that's what he knows. He says he would not have invaded Iraq in 2003. He was against that war. But as long as we did it, we ought to steal all their oil and, I guess, just starve them all out until everybody quits opposing us. And that goes for the Islamic State and their deadly enemies, the Iranians, too, he says. And yet you say that it's just a lie when Donald Trump brags that he is the most militarist man in the race.
Yeah, he just can't compete with not only the Republican field, but I'm not sure he can compete in terms of bellicosity with the current Democratic president or the most likely Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton. I mean, look, Trump is a clown and a bore and an embarrassment and many of the bad things that people have said about him. But it, when we're supposed to think that he's the most militaristic person in the race, good luck. You know, to borrow his phrase, most of the GOP field in particular has blood coming out of their eyeballs.
Yeah, he's a loser compared to them.
Well, you got when you're talking about militarism, you got Scott Walker, who said that he may very possibly have to bomb Iran on day one of his presidency. You've got Marco Rubio, who got out in front of the administration on the Libyan misadventure and who's actually made his campaign slogan a new American century. I think that Donald's going to have a tough time being more militaristic than these guys. It's not even a mention in the JV level. Lindsey Graham, who said that he'd literally use the military to keep Congress in session to restore a bigger defense budget. He's a piker compared to some of these guys.
Yeah, I mean, and you know what? I don't really doubt that he means it when he says stuff like that, Lindsey Graham. But, and in fact, it's not that Trump hasn't gotten around to addressing these things either. I mean, he actually has said that he would not rip up the agreement with Iran, but, he would police the hell out of it, and boy, would he catch them if they ever tried to cheat it or anything like that. You're right. Walker's position, for starters, and for one, and really the rest of them too, have been, or I don't know if they've all been as specific as Walker, but they've all come out much more strongly against the deal than Trump has, I think.
Even some of the candidates that you get the sense want to take a slightly more restrained tack on military intervention, like Jeb Bush. Are quickly forced back in a line. You know, I point out in the piece that a guy named Elbridge Colby was in line to be the campaign's foreign policy director, but it turned out that he'd written some skeptical pieces on the wisdom of bombing Iran, and that's just enough that you blocked in this sort of race. Jeb was made to understand pretty quickly that it wouldn't be prudent to hire somebody that doesn't want to attack Iran.
Yeah. Well, and it was really instructive, I think, the whole controversy over James Baker III there, where, this is a guy who's at the very, highest levels of the American establishment, you would think, the lawyer for every oil company in the world, pretty much. And he dared to give a talk to J Street And that got Bush in major trouble. He was crawling on his belly for weeks after that.
Yeah, it looks like whatever realist strain was left in his father's administration, he's been told that that's not going to fly in the 2015 Republican Party. And you know, you look at the others, Rubio, Walker, Rand Paul has backed away pretty heavily from some of his past non-interventionist positions. So I really don't see a guy like Trump being able to compete with the level of militarism that's par for the course in the Republican field.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's funny today. There's a piece by Michael Brennan Doherty in The Week talking about how all of these guys are contradicting themselves all over the place about, you know, fighting against Iran and for Iran and all these wars all at the same time, and how they can't make up their mind. Probably most of them really don't know what they're talking about. They often speak as though the Islamic State is an Iranian-backed terrorist group in Iraq or something like that. And then in Syria, you know, if you really do pin them down, then they say, yes, we need to create a whole brand new army to take on al-Nusra, ISIS, Assad, Hezbollah, and, you know, anybody else who dares to resist us, too. And that's their plan. Hey, like Walker said, full-scale reinvasion of Iraq if we have to drive the Islamic State out of Mosul, et cetera.
Yeah, that's right. He was given, it was about a month ago, a reporter, gave him several chances to say, I'm not for a full-blown reinvasion of Iraq, and Walker wouldn't take the bait. There's no getting around the right flank on some of these guys, and it's very odd because militarism isn't something that, you know, was supposed to be a competition. It wasn't something you were supposed to brag about. It like I said in the piece, these guys like to quote the founding fathers. They're not getting it from the founding fathers. They're not getting it. James Madison, who said war is the true nurse of executive aggrandizement, and that the in no part of the Constitution was more wisdom to be found than in the clause that gives the powers of war and peace to Congress and not to the executive. That's viewed as old thinking in terms of the modern GOP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know what? The funny thing is, too, is it's just like we could have had this same conversation 4 years ago, even, that they're really behind the times, man. If they just think they can get up there and Giuliani us by saying 9/11 over and over again, even Republicans are over that. And I think in the first debate there, it really showed that Rand missed an opportunity to bash the war and to say, yeah, that's right. The Republican hawks destabilized the whole region. That did help lead to ISIS. He backed down from that, but then left it to Trump. And Trump said, basically, damn that war. I was against it then, and I was right. And how do you like that? And the crowd wasn't upset at Trump for that. And they didn't, you know, stand on their feet and rise to applause because they were the ones who were wrong about it back then when he was right. But they didn't hold it against him. Even Republicans got to concede now that, come on, man, if Saddam Hussein was there, none of this would be going on.
Right, but for some reason, the Republicans, you can't, a month or so ago when they had that round of questioning for all the candidates about was the Iraq war a mistake. I mean, it took enhanced interrogation to get any of these guys to say it was a mistake. Three or four rounds with Rubio before he gave up the ghost on that. Bush just last week, I believe, after having admitted it was a mistake, came back around and said, I think getting rid of Saddam Hussein was a pretty good deal.
Yep.
No love for Saddam Hussein, but it's not looking like the best deal in the world right about now.
Yep. All right, everybody, hold it right there. We're talking with Gene Healy about the cult of the upcoming president and his warmongering ways, whoever it is. He's vice president of the Cato Institute and Hillary on the other side of this break.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Which president will you worship next? That is the question. Gene Healy's got this article at The Federalist. Trump's biggest lie. I'm the most militarist person in this race. No way. The centrist moderate candidates are way more extreme than him. On a lot of things, it turns out. So here's what's going on here, and you kind of alluded to this in the article a bit here, Gene, is that they're pandering to people with power and money who are all completely right-wing lunatics, and especially on Middle East issues. And so it really doesn't matter whether the rank-and-file Republican voters are really excited about sending, you know, the son that they have left off to go die in another one of these things. They'll worry about fooling them with TV ads later. Right now, they got to raise the money to buy the TV ads. And so they're willing to just, you know, as you described, they're all just trying to one-up each other. You know, I'll nuke them then. If you want to send the 3rd Infantry Division, I'll send the entire Marine Corps. How do you like that? And just, you know, going completely nuts. But I wonder, how far do you think they can go before they, you know, have to start tracking back toward the middle again here?
Well, none of them have really, you know, Obama has perfected this form of apparently low-cost warfare where, you know, he bragged in his speech defending the Iran deal the other week that he's bombed 7 countries, I think he said, you know, and actually it's 8. There was a bombing in the Philippines in 2012 that the most transparent administration in history hasn't acknowledged yet. But the costs are not, you know, since Iraq and Afghanistan, the costs, the upfront costs, at least, of drone warfare aren't that salient to the American voter, but there's definitely a drive to show that you're, you know, more militarist than thou. But none of these guys have really come out and said they're for a massive ground troop presence in Iraq and Syria. They've sort of alluded to it, but, you know, when they're pressed on it, you don't see even any of the Republicans proposing something that would be that unpopular. Instead, they sort of just demonstrate toughness by trying to one-up each other in terms of how, you know, where they're willing to let the bombs loose. And, you know, that's something that's on both sides of the aisle. For some reason, Barack Obama still enjoys this reputation as a reluctant warrior when he, by the time he took the stage to deliver his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, he already launched several times the amount of drone attacks that George W. Bush did. You know, you mentioned in the lead up to the break, Hillary. I mean, there is the Donald can't begin to compete with her, and I'm not sure some of the Republican candidates can even compete with her long career of never finding a war that she didn't like.
Yeah, starting with what, at least Bosnia. Do we know about her? I guess Bill the Post, Gulf War I from the governorship of Arkansas. Not like anybody cared or was listening, but do we know about her position on anything on any of the conflicts before Bosnia 95?
I don't know what she said about Gulf War I, if she said anything at all. The the famous story from the biography for, what is it, Gail Sheehy biography in 2000, Hillary's Choice, was that it was war in Serbia that actually got Bill and Hill back together. She had, after the Lewinsky scandal broke, Hillary wasn't talking to Bill for about 8 months until she called him in March of 1999, and as Hillary put it later, I urged him to bomb. So Bill got the message that he might be half out of the doghouse if he launched an undeclared war in Serbia over the Kosovo crisis. From there, you got Hillary, of course, voting for the Iraq war, and her record as Secretary of State.
Well, wait. Slow down for a second, because on the Iraq war thing, I think it's important that, you know, we talk about, and nobody ever talks about this, about how when she was the senator voting for that war, she was also the wife of the guy who'd just been president for 8 years. And it was clear that when she was saying, okay, you know, this is necessary to do this and to give Bush the authority to do this, that she was, at least it seemed understood, that she was in a sense speaking for her husband too, that they had this very powerful consensus with the Clintons. And people would argue all the time, hey, even the Clintons say we got to do it. Even the Clintons say he's got weapons of mass destruction. And the inverse of that is she could have stopped the war. If she had gone out there and told the truth, Ron Paul style, and said, look, sorry, everybody, but I'm the wife of the guy who was just the president, and this is a bunch of crap. If they had a couple of warehouses of mustard left, we bombed it in 98. Don't believe them, you know, and folded her arms and said, hell no, and tried to rally all the Democrats against it. So there's a lot of responsibility on there. She wasn't just some Democratic senator at the time, it seems to me.
Well, I don't know how much, you know, but like I say, Bill Clinton certainly wasn't reluctant to bomb Iraq when he was president. I don't think Hillary was one of the, there's only a handful of senators who actually bothered to go and read the national intelligence estimate on Iraq in the run up to the war vote. I don't believe she was one of them. You know, I don't think she was ever, really against it. Her position on the war was pretty much like John Kerry's position on the war. You know, they both voted for it. Mm-hmm. And then when the war started, as everyone knew it would the following year, having given the president all that power, she managed to be against it before she was for it, after she was against it, you know, like Kerry did.
Right.
You know, it was very much like the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, where there's a massive delegation of war power to the president, which then he uses at the time of his choosing. And people who voted for it want to, you know, be in a position where they can deny that that's exactly what they were voting for.
Right.
That's pretty much her profile and courage on that issue when she was in the Senate.
Yeah, and of course, John Kerry had the same problem as Bill Clinton. I forget about Biden, but I know Kerry and Bill Clinton both had been forever embarrassed that they had opposed the first Gulf War, which was just great.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big stain on their political career, and so they were not going to take that chance again come 2002.
Biden voted for the Iraq War resolution, too, as I recall.
Oh, yeah, no, he certainly did in 02, but I mean in 91. Yeah. I forget if he was trying to live down a 91 vote or not.
He might have been. Yeah, you might be right about that.
I know Kerry certainly was.
It was a much closer vote. I believe Al Gore voted for the 91 resolution, a much closer vote. And then it was a giant success, despite the fact that it ushered in, you know, 20-plus years of U.S. involvement in the region in a much greater way than we had been during the Reagan administration. But Biden in the administration, all the insider accounts of the debates on various interventions, Biden was sort of against Libya, was against the Afghan surge, and on all of these things, Hillary Clinton was pushing the president once again, like she said about Bill, I urged him to bomb.
Right, yeah, they were even talking about for a while, it's now in the emails that she and her staff were talking about, this will be the Clinton Doctrine, you know, named after her, not Bill, about how we intervene, we get the French to drop our bombs and then leave and just watch the country we just destroyed just burn.
Yeah, and now it's a bigger terrorist cesspool than it ever was under Gaddafi. The region's, in the midst of collapse, and her epithet for Gaddafi and for that intervention was after Gaddafi got killed was, we came, we saw, he died. And at the time, I point out in the piece, the Donald was all he could do was brag that this one time he screwed Gaddafi on a land deal. I don't really think he can match the former first lady in terms of militarism when you look at that kind of record.
Yep. Yeah, well, and especially it is worth pointing out, too, not for libertarian morals, but in terms of state politics, that they betrayed Gaddafi, who they had made a deal with and brought in from the cold, and he was torturing and imprisoning Al-Qaeda guys for us and gave up all his centrifuges he bought from AQ Khan, and then they still killed him. And that's, sets a bad precedent for dealing with future countries as well, obviously.
No, it definitely makes people more interested in getting nukes. If it's a way to prevent regime change, it's kind of a perverse incentive.
Yep, sure seems like it. I mean, you look at the example of North Korea, who scrambled, put together a couple of bombs, and we've left them alone since then. the Iranians are the ones, and Saddam's dead, of course, and the Iranians are the ones stuck in the middle here. We're going to see what happens there. But anyway, hey, thanks for coming back on the show, Gene. It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, same here. Thanks again.
All right, y'all, that's Gene Healy. He is vice president of the Cato Institute, cato.org, and he's the author of the book, The Cult of the Presidency. And we'll be right back.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is where I keep all the archives. Here live, noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time on the Liberty Radio Network, libertyradionetwork.com. All right, next up, it's our friend Gareth Porter, live via Skype from Lebanon. Hey, Gareth, how are you doing?
Hi, Scott, I'm fine. Thanks for having me again.
Very happy to have you here. So, you wrote a thing, and that's why I wanted you to come on the show, so you could talk about the thing that you wrote. Don't expect much change in post-Vienna U.S. Middle East policy by Gareth Porter. I'm not so sure if I mind that because change could be for the worse anyway. But let's see. You really you go through quite a few different statements by the president recently, beginning with his big speech at American University in favor of the deal, analyzing what it is that Obama says and doesn't say about the future of America's relationship with Iran. So go ahead.
You know, Scott, this is a bit of an unusual piece for me in the sense that it's really not about something that is happening. It's about what's not happening. It's the dog that hasn't barked. The dog being, in this case, any sign that the Obama administration and Obama personally has an intention to take a more aggressive diplomatic posture in the region that would begin to move away from the loyalty that has been shown to the Saudis, in particular, in regard to the regional issues with the regional conflicts between the Sunni
Oh, did I lose you? Hey. I wonder which intelligence service is interfering with our conversation here. Let's see. Yeah, should have called them. Oh, there you are. Can I hear you now? Nope. Skype, man. That's the thing about Skype. Plain old copper wires. Plain old telephone service. It doesn't sound as good, but it's so much more consistent. It's more expensive. But this kind of thing is a problematic problem. When you're trying to do a live radio show. Hey, how about now? Hey, Gareth, can I hear you? Can you hear me? Negative. More Skype problems. Well, that's just a shame, I think. Here he was saying a thing about a thing. Very important subject. I got questions. Iran and Saudi. The future. The lifting of the sanctions. What does it all mean? All right, well, I will now try to call him back. His symbol's still green, y'all. Gareth's symbol is still green. The article is "Don't Expect Much Change in Post-Vienna U.S. Middle East Policy" by Gareth Porter. Yeah. Well, this just ain't working. Tell you what I'll do. I'll goof off for 5 minutes. Nah, maybe I'll play some audio for you, and then I'll call Gareth on the phone.
Hi.
Oh, there you are. I was just about to give up and call you.
Yeah, we had the electricity cut off here.
Oh, really?
A moment ago, and things went dark, and then the lights came on again. That obviously cut our call in half, but glad we were back together again.
All right. Yeah, me too. Okay, so the last word I heard you say was Sunnis. We were talking about the split between Saudi and Iran and whether this nuclear deal is going to change that.
Right, and you know, I mean, a lot of people in Washington, this is the premise of my piece, Scott, a lot of people in Washington who are not, who are strong supporters of this agreement, you know, would like to think that Obama is going to, once this is safely approved by Congress, and he doesn't have to follow the script that is written essentially by the Israeli lobby and by the Saudis, that he can then and will begin to talk like a rational head of state and talk about what needs to be done to reduce these conflicts and knock heads together diplomatically. So to speak. So my piece is really looking at the evidence and saying, well, no, I'm sorry. The evidence really doesn't show any sign that this is about to happen, in a couple of months, two or three months, if this agreement, as we, all hope, does in fact go through. And on the contrary, his words starting, as you correctly began the question with the speech at American University seems to suggest the absence of any clear-cut conception of any role the United States might play after the Vienna Agreement. And the American University speech I thought was particularly telling because, you know, if you're going to ever say anything that's going to be suggesting the intention of playing a role as peacemaker, of changing the direction of U.S. policy in the Middle East, then certainly, you know, the 52nd, I guess it was, anniversary of, or was it the 53rd anniversary of the American University speech by JFK would be the time to do it. But as I read that speech, I find absolutely nothing suggesting that he has any thought of acting in the spirit of JFK's American University speech and its general central notion that it's time to move from confrontation to a negotiation with the main foe, that's going to be applied to the Middle East. And on the contrary, it seemed to me all that he did was to say, we're going to be better off with this agreement than we would be without it. It was entirely devoted to defending the agreement per se, and not a word of it really went beyond that.
Yeah. Well, then again, maybe it's just never mind comparisons to the USSR back when or whatever. In this current climate, trying to, you know, mix any other issues with the nuclear deal is a deal killer. And so let's just deal with this, and then we'll worry about, the fact that we're fighting for Iran in Iraq again still this whole time anyway, whether we're working with them directly or not, right? Like, who cares whether Odierno actually has Soleimani on the phone? You know, our government is at their service.
Well, I think that's correct. And the key point that you made, I think, was to emphasize that, it's the climate, it's the political climate that determines what Obama is able and willing to say about regional politics and policy in the Middle East. And that political climate is so much more decisively right-wing today than it was in 1963, I think I would argue, that does in fact impose very tight constraints on what we can expect reasonably from President Obama. And of
all
course,
right, now I wasn't around, but really, as far as
I mean, look, I mean, I'm not suggesting that it was a liberal climate in 1963 by any means, and let's bear in mind that
maybe just a little bit more grounded in actual facts rather than pure propaganda, like, you know, the war party now.
Well, I mean, you know, one can say that there are a lot of parallels between 1963 and today, in the sense that Kennedy felt it necessary to subvert his own administration's policy toward Vietnam, for example, as I document in my book about how the United States went to war in Vietnam.
Right.
So that definitely is a parallel, but I think that the present constraints go even farther than that.
All right, well, hold it right there, Gareth. We got to take this dang break, and then we'll be back. It's Gareth Porter. Check him out at original.antiwar.com/Porter. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Gareth Porter. We're talking about what all the Iran deal really means in terms of the rest of America's relationship with the Middle East. And my thing is, Gareth, is I don't really want the U.S. to get along better with Iran other than just to stop threatening them with aggressive warfare all the time. Stay within the NPT and we're cool. And in fact, even then, they got the right to withdraw from the NPT. What the hell do I care? I want America to just completely butt out. And I'm afraid that if we do start, if the U.S. government does start getting along better with their government, that means fighting for, you know, the Dawud Party, the Supreme Islamic Council, and the Baath Brigade, just like before, again, more. And in fact, probably in a way that'll just make the problem with the Islamic State worse. If everything we do just plays directly into their narrative that it's the Americans, the Shiites, and the Jewish Israelis lined up against them, and that they're the American Christian, you know, North American crusaders and whatever, and if all our government is doing is proving that they're right about us, according, you know, in the way they frame it in their rhetoric, then doesn't that just make them more powerful? And if Iran wants to fight the Islamic State, shouldn't we just butt the hell out rather than work with them on such a project?
Well, you know, frankly, I don't differ with you very much with regard to the issue of within Iraq of the U.S. cooperating militarily to defeat ISIS. I think that is a dangerous notion, dangerous situation. But I would just point out that the Middle East also involves Syria and Yemen and Lebanon. And that, in fact, what we're talking about here is a region-wide situation where the Saudis are on a rampage. They have a Sunni coalition of states that is in one fashion or another sort of going along with, if not actively, as in the case of Yemen, militarily participating in a war that is wrecking that country and carrying out a humanitarian disaster of massive proportions. So, I mean, I think we're talking here about a situation in the Middle East which, demands a diplomacy that does not have to do with military cooperation at all, but rather is the opposite. It has to do with the United States playing the role of saying, look, Iran and Saudi Arabia, it's time to cut out the bullshit, pardon the expression, and sit down and get this done. Have an understanding that is going to end these conflicts. And that means, leaning on the Saudis very heavily. So, it's necessary really to stop the demonization of Iran. That's the minimum requirement. Mm-hmm. For this kind of policy to emerge. And what I'm suggesting in my article, although, I don't go into it in detail, is that the rhetoric that we're getting from Obama is really still moving in the opposite direction. It's still moving in the direction of the demonization of Iran. Right. And so that's really the problem that we face. Some people might read, as I suggest in the article, some of the ambiguous, extremely ambiguous or impossible to penetrate rhetoric in a couple of the interviews where he says, if everybody in the region were to shape up and realize that their main problem is chaos and ISIL, that would be great and we should welcome that, which is, I'm not exactly sure what that means. I don't think it means anything. One might optimistically read that as meaning that he's really intending to play that role diplomatically once he's free and clear of the danger of losing the vote in Congress. I doubt that because of the weight that he gives to continuing the demonization theme. There's simply no let up on that. His main argument in defending the agreement is that, we're better off in a region where the Iranians are continuing their misbehavior without nuclear weapons. And that has become the primary argument now, for him to combat the attack on the agreement from AIPAC and its friends.
That's certainly a very dangerous game to play there, buying into the war party's narrative 90%, but then with a different conclusion. That's why we ought to do it my way. It's this or war rather than it's this or, hopefully they'll still remain within their safeguards agreement in the NPT. And then maybe we could work out a better agreement later someday or something,
The other angle that I want to mention is that without a shift in the diplomatic posture of the United States toward the region and particularly toward Iran and Saudi Arabia, the United States is still going to be defending whatever the Saudis do, whatever the Saudis' clients do, in order to make sure that we can hold on to our military bases. In other words, the tight linkage here between the fealty, if you will, to the Saudi line in the Middle East on one hand, And the interests of the national security state in making sure that we're going to hold on to those bases throughout the region, which are all in the Sunni Arab states, which in one way or another are affiliated with or associated with the Saudi strategy, that is going to continue.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, and I'm sorry because I don't think you've written about this or anything, and I don't know whether you know, but I hope you do. The last good thing that I read about America's role in the Yemen war was in the Wall Street Journal like 6 weeks ago or something, saying more or less that, yeah, America's running the thing. It's our, they don't say our planes and ships, but they say it's our spies picking the targets and our officers are the command and control. They're the air traffic control for the Saudi coalition, which does include a lot of different countries, have sent bombers to go and help them in their war over there. But can you tell me to what degree Obama owns that war? The U.S., the DOD owns that war over there?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. This has become not an American war per se, but a war that the United States is up to its neck involved in and supports, has said nothing up to now, has not said one word to indicate that it frowns upon, is worried about, or intends to pull the plug on this terrible war that the Saudis are waging in Yemen. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that that is part of the price that Obama is prepared to pay to maintain the close alliance with the Saudis. And, you know, that's really where the rubber hits the road. Is he going to be willing to put distance, real distance, between himself and the Saudis in order to have an independent diplomatic posture in the region? So far, no sign of it.
Yeah. And by the way, here it is. It's in the Washington Post today. In parts of Yemen, rebels have lost control. No one else has it yet. Yahan, Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I mean, there's no question Al-Qaeda is taking advantage. Nobody's really doubting that. Nobody's expressing the slightest doubt.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can read it right here. All right, thanks. Yeah. We're over time. Got to go. Thanks, Gareth Porter, everybody. Manufactured Crisis is the book. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism vs. Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism vs. Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. So today, I believe, is the hearing for Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning, sorry, to see whether she is going to be locked in solitary confinement indefinitely for the infraction of expired toothpaste and a Vanity Fair and the Senate torture report. I talked to her lawyer on the show. You heard it a couple days ago. Chelsea Manning could not possess any of those written materials without them going through the official process and being cleared by the jailers at the military brig. The horrible... I don't know what you call it. Not quite hell, but better, you know, worse than purgatory. Some kind of crap. State custody. How in the hell did the Vanity Fair get in there? The bosses said it was okay, period. No exceptions. That's what happened. Didn't get smuggled in there. And anyway, It's just an excuse for them to crack down on somebody that they hate because, as Marcy Wheeler points out on her blog today, Chelsea Manning is a writer for The Guardian and keeps condemning torture from inside her military dungeon. And so, you know what? To the hole with you. Using as their excuse, toothpaste expired in April. Does it even really have an expiration date on it? And where did Chelsea Manning get that toothpaste? Smuggled in from the black market expired toothpaste dealers? Or from the jailers at the military prison who are making up this crap? And anyway, why should anybody care, right? Because Chelsea Manning, what, is God's gift to journalism in the 21st century. That's what. Chelsea Manning provided the free press of the Western world and beyond with hundreds, literally hundreds, of huge and important news stories about the corruption and criminality of the American Empire. The collateral damage, collateral murder video, the Iraq and Afghan war logs, the Guantanamo files, and the State Department cables are together the sources for hundreds of important news stories. Robert Gates, the George W. Bush appointed Republican Secretary of Defense who stayed on into the Obama years, confirmed no one was ever killed. They did all the damage assessments in the world. No American sources or even snitches in Afghanistan or anywhere were killed because of the information leaked by Bradley Manning. And even if a few had been, if a couple of spies had been rolled up or whatever, then still those are the breaks for as important as it was. But do you remember 2010? Blood on his hands. Blood on his hands. All you Republicans especially, chant along with me now. Blood on his hands. Blood on his hands. Yeah, that's from you crucifying him. Because you're stupid. And you believe what they tell you because you just, I don't know why. Nope, it was the Defense Department and the State Department that had blood on their hands, blood on their hands, blood on their hands. And the American hero, Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, who told the truth about them to you. And again, the rat, Adrian Lamo, who had befriended Chelsea Manning on the chat log thing, who turned him over to the FBI, tried to entice him into treason. Hey, Bradley, why don't you sell the secrets to the Russians or the Chinese? I bet they'll give you a lot of money. And Manning said, no, man, that's not why I'm doing this. I believe in democracy, and I believe that if the American people know the truth and the people of the world know the truth, then they will make, you know, humanitarian reforms and they'll do the right thing. Because that's what I learned in government schools, how democracy works. It's why I know I can trust the government, because the government is a democracy where the people rule when they know the truth and can make informed adult decisions about what should happen or stop happening. Yeah, treason. Blood on his hands. And why did Bradley Manning do such a thing? Here's the story. Iraqi police arrest political dissidents. There's one where Manning has the story translated, and it's an essay called Where Did the Money Go? About political corruption in the American installed democracy there. Just exactly the kind of free speech that you would expect to read in any American newspaper, even in America's ridiculous, biased, pro-state media that we have now. Where did the money go? For this person was going to be sent off to be tortured and maybe to death, maybe disappeared forever. For writing an essay saying, hey man, what's up on some corruption in Baghdad? And Manning went to superior officer and said, Captain, Lieutenant, General, whoever you are, Colonel, this guy's innocent. Did you know? They're going to take him off and torture him just because he wrote a political essay for the local newspaper. Can you believe that? Help me intervene to save him. And the commanding officer said, that's right, Manning. Get back to work. Helping the Iraqi police take this guy off, processing him to be taken off to be tortured and maybe never see the light of day again. Hey, maybe they'll put a power drill through his skull. Maybe they'll bury him alive like the CIA. Get back to work, specialist. And so Manning said, oh yeah, well screw you, man. I'm leaking all of these secret, not top secret, sources and methods. Secret and confidential level documents that expose the truth about this war to the people of the world. American hero, Bradley Manning. As far as the transgender thing, whatever, I don't care about crap like that. The only reason I care about it in this case is it's slightly annoying because it distracts from the important issue of the documents to the subject, the personality of Manning and of Assange, too, for that matter, off of the news story. And so, you know, that's the only part that annoys me about it, that becomes the issue. When, in fact, holy crap, did you read about the Wolf Brigade torturing people to death with power drills? Did you read about the civilian casualties from America's war against the people of Afghanistan? Did you read about how George W. Bush forced Ethiopia to invade and destroy Somalia in Christmas 2006? Did you read about the, who knows, I wish I could do better off the top of my head. Scores and scores and hundreds of important stories. And even new stuff that comes out. New stories come out all the time where somewhere in there they go, and you know what? You go back and check the WikiLeaks, which is a shorthand for the State Department cables, usually. Then we find that, oh yeah, see, here's a little kernel of truth to add to that. Oh yeah, all about the Israelis and putting the children of Gaza on a diet. Yes, see, we want them to be hungry, but not starving. That's Israeli policy, according to American State Department cables describing it. On and on and on and on and on. The celebrated American hero, Chelsea Manning, who I can't believe is doing 35 years in the brig, who I can't believe is now, they're deciding today whether she's going to solitary confinement torture again. Indefinite solitary confinement over toothpaste is their excuse. In America, in the homeland, you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And so, yeah, this is where I talk about stuff. Mostly about how much I hate the government and especially the wars and the cops, obviously. The worst parts of it. Yeah, man. So, okay, I guess that's all I got to say about the Manning thing. Completely ridiculous. If I want to focus on some good news, I guess I'll talk about the Iran deal thing here for a minute, a little bit about it. First of all, Iran handed over a big sheaf of documents about whatever nuclear activities, trying to debunk the PMD. The IAEA, I think they already had an agreement about here's what we're going to give you, and the IAEA already said, well, if you did so, then that would resolve our questions, and so now they're doing it. The IAEA had already said that they're assured that all the PMD, the so-called possible military dimensions, will all be put to bed by December, and which that's going to be hard because most of them are forgeries, and the IAEA, i.e. Western side, can't admit that. And the Iranians, of course, they're going to have to find a way to debunk it other than saying, come on, this is obviously forged in Tel Aviv. Give me a break. So, you know, I don't know exactly if they're going to do it, but the Iranians are basically saying, here's our papers, man. Here's more papers. Here's what we got. You know, further solutions forthcoming there. And then there are a couple of Republicans who've come out. Brent Scowcroft, who I think it's fair to say when Brent Scowcroft says a thing that you can take that to mean he's speaking for George Bush Sr. And the reason I say that is because I think he's widely interpreted as speaking for Bush Sr. and still does it and doesn't ever say, now, listen, I'm not speaking for Bush Sr. or anything. So that's my understanding, is that when Scowcroft talks, that's Bush Sr.'s national security advisor, bestest friend in the whole world, co-author of his memoirs of his time in office and everything. When he wrote, don't attack Saddam, in the Wall Street Journal in, what, September or October 2002, boy, did that piss off Junior. For Dad to send his guy out to write a thing in the Wall Street Journal because he couldn't get a meeting in the White House. That's in the movie W by Oliver Stone, if you've ever seen it. I don't want to hear another word out of Scowcroft. When? Scowcroft, I think, probably fair to say, speaking for Bush Sr., has come out for the Iran nuclear deal. Dick Lugar, who, you know, I know he's kind of a scumbag, but he's made nuclear weapons and nuclear materials an interest of his beyond just what he has to do for politics. I think he made it a real interest. And, you know, it's the guy that did the Nunn-Lugar Act to buy up all the extra Soviet nuclear material, which is one government program that I'd support, compared to the other reality, which would be huge amounts of excess nuclear material floating around in the black market, fissile material. There's that, and then Hank Paulson, I don't really care about that. That probably is more of a discredit to the thing than anything else there. But then there's also Gary Samore. And Gary Samore is a guy who worked for Obama and then left the Obama administration to join United Against the Nuclear Iran, the Israel lobby, you know, attempted sabotage of the deal. And he opposed it. And you probably heard Gareth Porter on the show say over and over again, yeah, and then Gary Samore, he tries to spin it this way, but it's obviously that. Well, here he has now, isn't this interesting? He's the head of United Against Nuclear Iran, right? So what happens? He changes his mind. He now supports the nuclear deal. So what happens? United Against Nuclear Iran announces that, okay, cool, we're satisfied. No. He's fired. They run Gary Samore out, and they replace him with Joe Lieberman. Joe Lieberman? Is that guy still a person? God dang it. So anyway, Gary Samore comes out and is like, nah, you know, the deal is good. It's fine. And this is a guy who, you know, has been along the lines of Ollie Heinonen, basically. But so over at Vox, which is a ridiculous joke, I'm sorry, but that's who talked to him, okay? It's Max Fisher. Gary Samore, a leading skeptic of the Iran deal, explains why he changed his mind. And he says, yeah, you know, man, I believe the Ayatollah when he said, there's no way we're going to dismantle any centrifuges at all. But then, yeah, of course, he was just bluffing, and that was just for public consumption. And in the deal, they actually dismantle more than two-thirds, actually more than three-quarters of their centrifuges, something along those lines. So, wow, there you go. I was pleasantly surprised that they had accepted all these constraints. And so, okay, there you go. Good enough for me. He actually says, I wish I had a good. Oh, yeah, here it is. I made the mistake of believing him. When the Ayatollah said, we will not accept dismantlement of any of our existing centrifuges, quote, I made the mistake of believing him. But then, when the framework terms were released, it was clear his red lines were simply bluster. Yeah, of course. So there you go. Oh, man, and you know what? That reminds me of what I was going to ask Gareth, and then he changed the subject on me, and I forgot, which was just how much lifting the sanctions changes the whole dang thing. God, what a disaster of an interview without that question. You know what? I'm going to call Gareth back in a minute and ask that question to him and tack it on to the end of that interview for you. Maybe it's too late. Well, I should have jotted it down, because sometimes I forget the things that I wanted to say. Oh, well. So anyway, there's a couple more indications that the deal's going to pass. Pelosi says she has the votes in the House of Representatives. I don't know about in the Senate. And you know, another thing I thought about asking Gareth about, but we didn't have the time to do it, was asking Gareth about the Israel lobby and the politics of Netanyahu and AIPAC and the related neoconservative-led think tanks coming out so strongly against this deal, where they're going to such lengths to accuse anyone who notices what's going on of being an anti-Semite. And in fact, there's an article today in The Forward, which, if you're not familiar, is the Jewish Daily Forward, and their editor, J.J. Goldberg, has an article ruthlessly attacking the neocons who are accusing Obama and Kerry of being anti-Semites and of trafficking in anti-Semitic dog whistles and nostrums and these kinds of things, because Obama had said, well, look, you know, there are lobbyists trying to end the deal. Oh, lobbyist, that's a secret code word for Jew, supposedly, except that everybody knows that there's no interest group in America except the Israel lobby, and that the Israel lobby canceled all their Stas vacation. AIPAC canceled all their Stas vacation. Netanyahu gave a talk to 10,000, supposedly 10,000 people on a streaming video message from different Jewish groups around America demanding that they fall in line as Israel first or Jews before American citizens and oppose the government deal based on the fact of their Jewishness, which I think probably many of them must have told them to go to hell, right? Or I guess maybe not the people if they were on the conference call, then maybe they were into that in the first place or something. But polls say that a majority of American Jews support the president and on this deal especially. But to point out that Israel is attempting to use dual loyalty of hawkish American Jews to lobby Congress in order to thwart the deal, that ain't a secret. That's their openly declared policy. To say that anyone pointing that out is an anti-Semite is kind of ridiculous at this point. And J.J. Goldberg is not having it at all. You can go read his article in The Forward, where, you know, he basically says, how dare you say that Obama and Kerry are anti-Semitic for pointing out who their opposition is? Every government on the planet supports this deal. In fact, if you poll them, the population of every country on the planet supports this deal. The only exception is Israel and the Republican Party in America. But most Americans support the deal. So, and there's just no question of who's the power in Washington, D.C. There's no question about why the Republican Party panders so bad on this issue. It's because of the money of Sheldon Adelson, who is also the number one billionaire bankroller of the Likud party and Benjamin Netanyahu and his fortunes in Israel as well.